This April, the small nonprofit is being sponsored by Troy Mailing. That's T-R-O-I Mailing. Friends, I've personally been using Troy's printing and mailing services for almost 5 years now. I choose them for my clients, and I chose them when I was in-house. They are great to work with, always get my brand colors right, are cost-effective, and get my mailouts to my donors on time, even during busy seasons. Call 1-866-876-4624 for a free $100 postage credit when you use promo code DONORDM1 on your next campaign. Thank you, Troy Mailing, for sponsoring the small nonprofit.
Welcome to the Small Nonprofit Podcast with down-to-earth practical advice on how to get things done in your small organization. You are going to change the world and we can help. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Cindy Wagman, and I'm joined by my co-host, Anya McGlynn.
Hi.
So today we have a really important conversation with our friend Adele Dalla, who is the executive director of the Center for Social Innovation here in Toronto. Now, he has a very personal reflection on their journey towards becoming an organization that, I guess, does better around equity and inclusion. And I think that one of the things he talks about is that this is a journey, right? It's not a destination. It's sort of ongoing work. And I think that that's really relevant for all of us to know and understand that we have to start where we are today and continue to take action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think CSI, they published the key findings of their demographic survey, which I felt was the right approach. I think in many cases at the heart of diversity and inclusion is transparency. So when we get familiar and comfortable with sharing where we are at, then we can sort of chart a path forward. We see transparency at the heart of the pay equity movement, right? When we start to disclose salaries, it becomes more difficult to reward people inequally for the same kind of work. So I think that, you know, Adil has taken a really important step in being very forthcoming about where CSI is and what kind of work they have yet to do. I also want to shout out the working group, TWG, who also published their work on becoming a more gender equitable company, especially in the field of technology. So they also sort of took that step towards saying, this is where we are, this is what we've done, and basically provided that as a case study and provided the tips and tools for other technology companies who want to work on being more inclusive and more diverse. So yeah, transparency. Go for it, guys. Mm-hmm.
As we go into the interview, I just want to give a little reflection. We did record this interview with Adil in advance of the interview we aired last week with Rania L. Mugamar, which taught us to reflect a little bit on our own language. And so you'll notice that some of what we talked about last week is not applied to this interview. And I want to take a moment to just to acknowledge that and to acknowledge that we're still learning and we hope you can learn from our learning. So here is the interview. Adil Dalla is a civic entrepreneur and community organizer who is driven to co-create new and inclusive economies. He is currently the executive director of the Center for Social Innovation Toronto. He was recently named a Bali Fellow, awarded to local economy leaders who are creating the new economy. He is the first Muslim to ever receive the honor. In addition to his role at CSI, he chairs the board for the award-winning Stop Gap Foundation, which focuses on improving physical accessibility in communities. He also co-founded and continues to chair Camp Reset, a nonprofit and acclaimed summer camp for adults that is uniquely addressing issues around mental health and loneliness for adults through play and digital detoxing. Please welcome Adil.
Hello.
I'm so excited to have you here. And before we get started, I'm hoping you can tell our listeners a little bit about the Center for Social Innovation by way of introducing your journey to becoming more inclusive.
Of course. And thank you so much for having me here today. The Center for Social Innovation is a nonprofit social enterprise. We started almost 15 years ago because our five founders all felt that there was a need for shared space for people who work in the realm of social enterprise and innovation in the city of Toronto. At the time, the concept of a bunch of social mission organizations sharing space seemed a bit out there. The prevailing thought was, what would happen if a bunch of nonprofits shared space? They'd probably compete for resources, talent, etc. But our founders actually believed in the potential of people. They believed that if we shared space, not only would we be making things more affordable and accessible to folks, but that the opportunity to connect and collide our respective networks and opportunities would mean that we could all rise together. And so that was the genesis of the idea. And you know, almost 15 years later, the Center for Social Innovation now has three beautiful homes in Toronto and affiliates in other cities outside of the city. And we are home to thousands of people who collectively share a common idea to put people and planet first, and who all put their hands up to join CSI because they want to be part of a community of people doing this work. And we provide them with space, but we also provide them with a bunch of services, coaching, programs, microloans to accelerate what they do. And most importantly, we provide and animate a community. Communities don't just happen. They require constant nurturing. And for me, really, over my last 8 years of CSI, specifically my last six as a staff member, I've been focused most on the animating and stewardship of our culture and our community.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's a great community, having been a member of that and seen a lot of charities and nonprofits and other social enterprises come out of there and grow and thrive there. And community over competition, it works for CSI. Tell me a little bit about where and when it became clear to you that your impact in the organization, or something you wanted to really look at and explore, was around equity and inclusion.
Well, it's hard for me to answer that without just giving a little bit of my own personal narrative, which predates the organization. You know, for many times in my life, growing up from a very early age, I experienced exclusion and, as a consequence, isolation. And as a consequence, I myself had my own passion around this topic. Mm-hmm. But I also, with the advantage of retrospect, I've also identified how I've kind of complied or been complicit with our inequitable world in multiple ways. And I'll give you a really, really obvious example. For me, when I started school and I introduced myself, most folks couldn't say my name, which is Adil. And so it morphed over the years from Adil to Adil to Adil. And then eventually people just went to Pickle because they figured out a good way to remember my name was Adil Pickle. And so this beautiful Arabic name, Adil, which means just, got transformed into Pickle. And it's a kind of funny story at this point, but my acceptance of that actually is really indicative of my own journey around feeling isolated and then feeling that I needed to conform in so many different ways in order to be included. Mm-hmm. And so when I found CSI, you know, about 8 years ago, I was feeling isolated myself at the time, particularly from a work perspective. I had just moved back to Toronto. I was looking to do social mission work, but I didn't know where to find it. And I remember the day that CSI, you know, the first time I ever encountered it, I came up the elevator over at our old location at 215 Spadina. I walked out and into the space, and there was open space and dogs walking around and a diversity of people. And I met the CEO, Tanya Sermon, and she explained to me what CSI was all about. And I knew I had found home. And for me, home at that point was a place of like-minded individuals. But I didn't filter it as a place for people who had similar shared, who had similar lived experiences to me and similar or different lived experiences than me. Mm-hmm. And it was only only when I moved into my role as a director of culture and I was invited to in this role to steward CSI's culture, did I begin to hear stories from other people who were both in and out of the community about their experiences not feeling welcome and excluded at times. And relating that to my own experience, I felt really sad about this and became more passionate about doing work within our community to make it more welcoming for more people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say I met you as Adil, but I will call you Adil from now on. And I think that that moment where you sort of reflected and said, this is happening beyond just my experience, a lot of people freeze in that moment. And you didn't. You took action. And you started a journey around changing that culture. Can you tell me a little bit about that, those first early days of saying, okay, this is something that's really important for us, not just to pay lip service to, but to take action around?
Yeah, of course. And to be honest, I had to have people, you know, not literally, but what felt like them shaking me to tell me to take action. You know, I'm so in love with what CSI is and what we do, that when I did hear people's experiences, as much as it did register as important to me, the step towards taking action was a lot harder. And I think a lot of that had to do, A, with me not wanting to ruin my perfect little bubble about what our community was, and B, because I also didn't want to confront the own work that I had to do. Mm-hmm. And so instances of exclusion occurred in our community, and it was hard. I registered them, but taking action on it was a leap that I struggled with, and I had incredible educators and activists and just humans around me, like Rania and Shelby and the like, who really had really confronted me on the issue. And particularly, there's one moment I'm thinking about that comes to mind, where we had an instance of Islamophobia in our community, and I myself am a Muslim man, and I remember Rania, who's an equity educator and artist and activist, and unquestionably one of my greatest teachers on this topic. And you know, Rania, she was really upset. She said, "Adil, we have to provide education in this community. Otherwise, people these matters will just get worse if we don't address them." And it took me a while to accept that, because I didn't want to acknowledge that we were a community where people didn't feel welcome. Mm-hmm. And so I really have to, you know, in short, answer your question by honoring, you know, the people I mentioned and many more, who were instrumental in helping me get moved to action. But here's what's interesting about that. Often the people who are doing the labor to bring attention to this issue are the people who either exist on the margins or have experience on the margins themselves. Mm-hmm. Leave a lot of the labor, as I did myself, to people who are facing exclusion in some way, and I see that now, and I want to make sure that I'm not perpetuating that cycle going further.
I think that's such an important point. Well, there's a few really important points there. One is that you had people around you who could speak up, and for better or for worse, you really relied on their gentle pushing or not so gentle pushing to get there. But I think your reflection now that that's not necessarily their responsibility, that that's your responsibility as a leader, is something that a lot of people can learn from. Can you tell us a little bit about how, now that you know and understand that, how can people be proactive instead of relying on people who are experiencing that exclusion? How can we take ownership of it ourselves when we're in a position of power?
You know, a number of things come to mind. First and foremost, you know, the power of education. You know, if we look at even like the context of in Canada, our relationship to the history of Indigenous peoples in our country. Like if you've grown up in Canada and gone through the Canadian education system, you have not gotten the honest or the full story as it relates to our role as settlers here. And so how could you possibly create an equitable community that is doing reconciliation in an authentic and meaningful way if you don't even know the actual history, the real history of our country? And I didn't know the real history. And it took an Indigenous elder, an educator, Bare Standing Tall, who's within the CSI community, to really educate me on the full, well, as much truth and honesty as he provided. And so I think that, you know, the hardest thing is actually just taking that step and learning. And the reason why that's hard is because we don't want to acknowledge that we ourselves are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. When we look at issues around gender or race or class discrimination, we look at the extreme examples and we say, that's not me. But the reality is that we all have our own lived experiences and we all have our own gaps because we don't have everybody else's lived experiences. Mm-hmm. And so being honest with ourselves is important in order to kind of making that leap, and education and the truth really sets us free. Mm-hmm. And that has been instrumental for me. And through that education, you know, one of the biggest things, you know, you use the word, you know, people who have power. One of the biggest things that I've had to grow a lot around was recognizing the amount of power that I hold, in part because of my identity, particularly as a man, in part because I have my leadership position, in part because of how I show up in the world. You know, the thing about acknowledging that you have biases and blinders and prejudice within you is that it feels like you, in the process, are giving up your power. But in actuality, my experience has been it's empowering to acknowledge my power. It's empowering to acknowledge where I need to do work on it. And that's been a really meaningful journey for me and really impactful as a leader.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the word journey, and I want to talk a little bit about that because this is an ongoing learning and education, right? It's not like you attend one workshop and you're educated around all the things. So can you tell us a little bit about your own ongoing learning and where you've really found the most impact and what you'd recommend for other people who are on that journey and looking to continue to be more aware of their own position and the position of others?
Of course. Well, I'll start by saying there's something within Buddhism that I really registered. I'm not Buddhist myself, but the sentiment really registered with me. And the line was, the only person you can judge are previous versions of yourself. And I shared that because ultimately the journey for me has been focused on self first and foremost. And other people are, you know, we're all at different parts of the spectrum. And I personally don't want to spend much energy judging where different people are at, because there's probably so many reasons where they are where they are. And I actually think it's really privileged that I've had the opportunity of education and incredible educators and community around me to be where I'm at, where what I've learned thus far. But I'll share a story actually of something that happened actually quite recently. For the past 4 years, I've been organizing a community adult digital detox event called Reset. Mm-hmm. And it happens every summer, and there's a lot of overlap with it and the CSI community. And I was one of the founders of it. And this past year, I actually took a step back from organizing, and a couple of my fellow co-founders have stepped in and into the leadership of it. And it was really exciting for me to just show up this year. What I didn't realize was there was an event that happened there called Mimosas and Samosas. And the idea of the event from the people who organized it there was to celebrate Asian culture within a festival sandbox, because those two things don't usually intersect. And I cried at that event. I had a lot of tears because I realized that when we founded Reset, there was 8 of us on the team that founded it. 4 of us were of Asian identity, and our identity did not show up in the event at all.
Wow.
And the connection that I made for myself is that for most of my life, I've been self-censoring my own identity because it didn't fit within the powerful or the in crowd or class. And so I'm really, you know, talking about journey, like I'm really at a journey at unlearning a lot of things myself, and including where I have been part of my own problem in terms of not actually prioritizing my culture. Even going back to that story I told you about the name, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't stand firm on what my actual name was. I conformed to that situation. And certainly I could hold some judgment about to others and to why society is the way it is and why I had to conform in certain ways. But ultimately that judgment doesn't serve me. What serves me is actually unlearning what exists within me right now, and trying to look forward with the recognition that I actually can now be part of a different story. And that's what I've been trying to do.
Fantastic. I think that articulation of at once being both part of, you know, holding power and being disempowered in other aspects of your identity is also really important. Like we don't just take up one position and it's fluid. So I think that's a really important thing to keep in our minds as we go through this journey.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, this is that comment is particularly important around my own learnings around gender. Mm-hmm. You know, as a man, particularly with a lot of power, I've been learning a lot around what it means to create more space, what it means to step back, and what it means to stand with. And you know, if I could, you know, be totally frank about this, you know, I remember when I first read the book Lean In, for example, I didn't actually understand what that meant for me in terms of where I go. And for years, I kind of struggled with that idea. But where I'm at now is, you know, exactly what you said, realizing that there's a fluidity to power, and that one of the best things I can do is let go of my need for power or my position in power, and not feel like that's actually a disempowering thing. In fact, actually, the most empowering thing you can do is actually share what you have. Mm-hmm. And that's been a really big lesson for me. And I still have so much work on that particular journey, and realizing how I can be a part of the solution. But I have a lot of work to do there.
We all do. I want to come back to that. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that in a minute. But first I want to talk about, or I want to hear from you about the project that you undertook at CSI around starting to benchmark and measure the experience of your members.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I think that's a huge step and often a very scary one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think, well, tell us a little bit about it and what you did.
So we've had, for the past 4 years, we've had a committee called the IDEA Committee at CSI. IDEA stands for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access. And the purpose of this committee has been to steward our work around these 4 pillars. And on that committee, we have a gentleman, Shaquille, who's belongs to an organization called Anima Leadership, which he leads along with his wife, Anahid. And Shaquille had suggested that we look into the idea, Shaquille being a community member or a member of the IDEA committee, Shaquille had suggested that we look into benchmarking our demographic data in our community. And so what we did was we used census questions to form a demographic survey, which we subsequently shared with our board, our staff, our community, and our volunteers. And we asked everything from folks' gender to their race to their religious practices. And just for context, all the information was, of course, private. And when information, demographic information, is collected for the purpose of improving one's diversity, then that is appropriate and legal. But otherwise, obviously, there's a lot more complexity around that. Mm-hmm. So we performed the survey in 2014, and then spent a couple of years learning, analyzing, and implementing from what the survey told us. And it has been one of my hardest professional journeys, in large part because it just surfaced so many of the things that I didn't know or didn't look for or didn't want to look for in telling the story of who's in our community and, more importantly, who's not. Mm-hmm. And I said this earlier in the talk, where I'm at now is the truth has set us free, and the truth, and I feel that really personally for myself, because instead of being choosing to be ignorant about who's not in our community, as Rania Mugamer, who I mentioned earlier, mentioned to me one time, she said, "Data saves us breath." Mm-hmm. It saves people the time, particularly the same people who are doing a lot of this labor over and over again. It saves them the time of proving or trying to tell us a story, and it tells the story for us. And it told us a story at CSI about a lot of work that we need to do, both inner and within the community. And it has set us free and put us towards a direction where we can actually meaningfully do the work of inclusion.
Fantastic. So what are those steps that you're taking? I mean, you mentioned before creating space, stepping back, and standing with or alongside. Can you talk about those and other things that you found are things that you're starting to implement?
Yes, of course. Fundamentally, people join communities, organizations, etc., when they see people that reflect themselves within those communities, especially for the communities that are the most marginalized, whose experiences traditionally have been the least safe. There is a relationship to feeling safer and more welcome when you see people who look like you within those organizations. And so that thinking has been really important for us. But the thing is, it just doesn't happen. And if you are specifically saying, oh, we're missing X community, let's focus on just getting that community, there's a real risk of just entering into the world of tokenizing. Mm-hmm. And so to do it meaningfully, what we've been trying to do is to ensure that our organization at the very highest of levels reflects the kind of community that we aspire to have. And so the results of the demographic survey sparked a series of conversations at a board level and subsequent action to renew the membership of our board to ensure that our board was in itself starting to be more reflective of the community that we aspire to be. And just for context, there was a question that came up of, well, how much is enough? And I don't know the answer to that question, but we benchmarked our data against the city of Toronto's because we found that it's like the most, the easiest thing to compare against in terms of seeing like, well, how do we fare? And we started looking at our board data that we had versus the city of Toronto's. And we started seeing, okay, well, where are the gaps? And then we worked from our board and started looking at our staff and so on and so forth. But the reason why our board and staff are so important in this is because, frankly, from a community and operations perspective, we make the majority of the decisions that happen at CSI. And those decisions are influenced by our lived experiences. Mm-hmm. And the dream to get to is that you don't have to think too much about including X community or Y community in a tokenizing way, because it's just happening, because from a decision and a leadership perspective, that thinking has already been factored in at the very beginning. And so I would say, look, taking a good long look at your leadership and who's at the table from a leadership perspective is one of the biggest things that we've done. The second thing, which I've already spoken about, is education. It is now mandatory for all of our staff and our volunteers to take diversity training, and not just one layer of it. There's multiple layers of that training that's provided to them. And as a further addition, our entire community gets access to free diversity and inclusion training on a variety of topics. And so we're creating a culture of learning and openness within our community. And so that's the second thing. And then I think, like, to bring up the demographic survey again, something I didn't mention is that we publicly published those results. Mm-hmm. And that was really important for us to do as for a lot of reasons, but particularly as a measure of accountability, particularly as a way of communicating to the people who are not reflected in our community that we are aware of where our shortfalls are and we want to do this work. And this is hard because in publishing these sort of results, we in many ways are acknowledging a lot of areas where we have work to do. And especially for an organization, for people who have power, for institutions, that's challenging to do because you don't want to look bad. But the reality is that, you know, if you can't really do the work until you're honest with people and yourselves about it. And so I feel like publishing the results for us was a really important measure of accountability and communication. And we subsequently have started to publish more about our work in this area, including everything from a new anti-discrimination harassment policy that we've created. And we've embedded that in all of our contracts within the community. To stories about the different work that's being done in the community on this topic, and that has really been powerful for us to do.
Fantastic. I think that is a very important point around building this into all levels of the organization. We're running out of time, but I want to end on one question, which is, going back, sort of combining a couple of thoughts. So one is that, you know, we all hold these various positions, and understanding that even if you get great diversity throughout the organization, and all of that is influencing decisions, and the organization is this sort of organism of diversity and inclusion, we still at the same time hold various positions of power, and those coexist. So can you talk a little bit about your own actions as a leader who simultaneously holds both of those positions? What are some of the things that you find yourself doing now or reflecting on now that you wouldn't have before?
Great question. I think, first of all, and this is connected to, you know, the question around, or my last point about communications, I'm not celebrating what our actions are in this area. I think this is really important. It's important to communicate, but there's a fine line between communicating and celebrating. And the reason why I want to make that distinction is when you celebrate, you know, the actions that you as an individual or you as a community might take around making it more inclusive, it feels like the action is more performative than genuine. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's been a really important learning for me. And I think we certainly at many points were, you know, wanting to really just tell one side of the story. And I think even, you know, recently we released a report around an event we did at Honest Eds called Toronto for Everyone. And it was an impact report. And we talked about all the wonderful things that we did, particularly around making the event more inclusive and welcoming to folks, but we also shared all of our learnings about where we failed to live up to those expectations and those ideals. And that was how we straddled, honoring the work that we did, but also not in a way that was, hey, look at us, we're so great. And I think this is just really important in terms of our mindset and what we're communicating. So I think that was a really big thing for me to learn. The other thing, it's come up a couple of times in our conversation, but it's important that I consistently am aware and name my power. Mm-hmm. Especially in situations where people are sharing their experiences with me and they haven't been great experiences, a lot of times because of the power that I hold, they may not be comfortable sharing that. And so that their issue of exclusion may not actually be reported on. And so the more I can do to create a safe space or safer space for them, by way of acknowledging that I do have power and by way of ensuring that I'm aware of that, I actually think that has been very helpful to really balance the vibe in a room and ensure people feel more comfortable speaking out of certain things. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think that for executive directors of small organizations and other listeners of ours, that's a struggle, right? To be a leader, but also to create that space or to find ways, if it's not people coming directly to you, to find other mechanisms to hear that feedback. What has that looked like and felt like and what has that been like for you?
I think, to the second part of what you mentioned, it's been really important that within our community, there's multiple people through whom feedback can come through. Simply because I recognize that not everyone's comfortable providing me with feedback, particularly in instances where I may be part or significant part of the problem. So I think as an executive director, you have to be comfortable and open and vulnerable to the idea that there's other people in your organization who may be better receivers of other people's experiences. And so that's been really important. And so often when I'm in rooms with folks who are providing feedback, I have someone in there with me. Often we're conscious to ensure that we both acknowledge and name our power in the room, and we often are conscious to acknowledge that there's other ways and other people to speak to. But I think, Cindy, I think this is the interesting thing. Power is fairly abundant, mm-hmm. and so as an executive director, holding on to my power doesn't make any sense, because in actuality, I want everyone to have power, because when we all have power, we all have the opportunity to rise into our highest selves and to do the work that we're going to do. And so I think the scarcity that we have often, and I've had, in the past, has limited my ability to create a genuine and safer space for people. And so I think that's a big part of that. I think one thing that I've found that's really been valuable from a cultural perspective is that at all community events and at many of our meetings right now, I start the meeting by providing a land acknowledgement. And the importance of that is I'm, of course, doing one of the types of work you can do around a reconciliation, but I'm also as hopefully communicating a message that at the kind of the top, highest level of the hierarchy within our organization, that that I believe that this work is important, and thereby communicating to others a certain openness to conversations and experiences, and that observation has come through feedback that I've been given from folks who have provided feedback in the past. So there's a lot here to unpack further, and I'm happy to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great starting point, and understanding that this is something that we can all work on an ongoing basis. And I think you've given us some really good starting points. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. I, um, It's just to acknowledge something. One more thing about, you know, power and privileges is it's been my privilege to both be in my position and to, as a consequence, have opportunities like this one. And one of the things, that you can do that I've learned that's really meaningful and valuable when you have privileges that provide opportunities like this one is to amplify others as much as possible who may not have this opportunity. So I've tried to do that and tried to model that. And you know, as it's come up many times in this conversation, I keep trying to get better. I have a lot of work to do. But I really appreciate this opportunity, Cindy.
Thank you. And actually, I was going to acknowledge that I know you don't do this work on your own and that you have a number of people that you've been really good at referencing or giving credit to around their work. So I want to acknowledge that too, because I know that there's many people alongside you in this, and that they're incredible and really doing great work together. So thanks to all of them as well.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you.
Excellent. If anyone wants to learn more about CSI or around the reports you've done or any other education and learning on this topic, where can they go?
I would, for CSI, obviously visiting our website at socialinnovation.org. And if you want to visit specifically our work on this in this area, socialinnovation.org/idea, IDEA. And I'm also happy, you know, I would recommend checking out the websites for Bear Standing Tall, Rania Al Mugammar, and Anima Leadership as being, you know, few of the people and organizations that have been really valuable to me. And you can actually find information about all of them through our website as well. I would start there as some external resources to us.
Fantastic. We'll include all those links in the show notes. Thank you so much. And we'll leave it there. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that's it for today's episode of The Small Nonprofit. I'm your host, Cindy Wagman, and this show is brought to you by The Good Partnership. As a reminder, if you want more resources around raising more money for your small nonprofit, visit thegoodpartnership.com and download our free fundraising strategy guide. I'll see you next week.